Geopolitics and Empire is joined by Jack Buffington, who's Director of Supply Chain and Sustainability at First Key Consulting and Professor and Academic Director of the Supply Chain Management Program at the University of Denver. He's the author of several books, including The Recycling Myth, Peak Plastic, and his latest just published, which we will be discussing, Reinventing the Supply Chain, a 21st Century Covenant with America. Welcome to Geopolitics and Empire, Professor Buffington.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and you noticed how we've almost got matching shirts, so that happens sometimes. I guess we can thank the supply chain for that. But I've been reading your book. I do very much enjoy it, and I think it's an important topic that we have to be looking at more and more. Supply chains, right? We're talking about globalization, deglobalization, nearshoring, reshoring. In the face of so many things that are going on, the pandemic, the Ukraine war, decoupling from China. And maybe a good place to start is to look at how great America used to be in manufacturing and supply chain and how we lost it. You discussed, after World War II, the U.S. economy was the largest globally with no other nation even close. And, how this relates to the actual war, where the government was afraid that with the end of the war machine economy, tens of millions of Americans would be put out of work. They transitioned from government-directed command and control wartime economy to a new consumer economy. So if you can sort of start us off there on how was America before, and then how we sort of what happened and how we transitioned out of that.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a very comprehensive answer to that question. So I'll try to keep it short. The United States became the world's leader when it came to supply chain and manufacturing through principles of structured problem solving, which basically industry started through the power of fossil fuels, right? So I tell people that there wasn't a thing such as a supply chain before fossil fuels. There was globalization, but that's much different than what's happened since with supply chain. So oil has been the lubricant, and the glue has been organization and structure and process. So that was what allowed the United States to become the world leader in manufacturing, helped the United States win the war, be the leader in World War II through material production. And if you look at the production of tanks and planes and everything like that, it was enormous. But then, like you mentioned, there was this problem after the war. Like we have all this manufacturing capacity. We don't have any demand. The United States was really a focus on a supply economy. And then after that transition to a consumer economy, supply chains are the complete demonstration of capitalism. So through the capacity of supply chains expanded across the world through shipping, technology, next thing you know, the United States moves from being a supply-based economy to a consumer-based economy, to which still is the case today. And now we're seeing a breakdown of globalization and supply chains through what's happening with geopolitics. One topic I hope we get into is what's happening regarding to demographics, which is decline of the world population, which is also playing into it. So we're in a fascinating time when it comes to what's happening in the world and in the supply chain.
Riots across Europe, unprecedented food and energy inflation, increasing military conflict around the globe, and a rising digital police state. The fourth turning is here, and so is the Expat Money Summit. The free online event, expatmoneysummit.com, is back and will help you navigate these turbulent times. Featuring dozens of renowned experts such as Dr. Ron Paul, international man Doug Casey, Jim Rogers, and Mark Faber, the summit will reveal how you can reclaim your freedom abroad, reduce your tax bill, protect your wealth, obtain multiple citizenships and residencies, become part of a like-minded global community, and more. Founder of expatmoney.com, Mikhail Thorup, will be your guide on this journey to protect yourself from economic collapse, World War III, authoritarian Western regimes, and Klaus Schwab's Great Reset. Simply go to expatmoneysummit.com and enter your email to reserve a free ticket to the event. Do it now. Maybe this topic will sound boorish for some listeners, but I can't be having the same old, sort of topics that I deal with. And as myself as a former professor, it's important to understand the things that Professor Buffington talks about to better understand what's happening in the world. And there are a lot of things, especially in the first half of your book, that are fascinating, that are new to me. And you also discuss how these capitalist planners discussed ending the depression through planned obsolescence. I mean, we all have examples. I can remember, you know, 20 years ago when I was a teenager, I bought a Panasonic stereo, and literally after the 1 year warranty finished, like the day after, the lens on the CD reader stopped working. And so could you tell us more about, you know, how this planned obsolescence also was important in keeping these things going?
Yeah. So what happened was, is that the first generation after World War II, you know, mind you, in the United States and a bunch of countries faced two world wars. They faced the Great Depression. And so, you know, they unleashed the consumer. And so the consumers were all excited about getting a refrigerator and a car. But then, you know, the companies were like, well, what happens after that? You know, what happens? You know, how do we encourage more consumption? So this tool called marketing came about, which, by the way, the founder of marketing, whose uncle was a guy named Sigmund Freud. So he used, you know, the use of technology or of psychology to get people to not buy what they need, but buy what they want. And then, you know, tie it to social status and everything like that. So that was one way that you could expand demand. The other way of expanding demand is for things like you mentioned to run out at a certain point in time. And that first started off with how they made things. But in today's world, the level of quality in the products that we have are really, really high. And so it's not a matter as much as something breaking down, but it is more of like a single use. You know, when it comes to fashion and consumer products, is that, you know, like if when I was a kid, if I got a hole in my pants, I was like scared to go home because my mom would have to patch it, where now you just throw it away. So it changed us as how we, not only how we produce, but how we consume. And it really changed our culture. And this is all due to these supply chains where, you know, that pair of jeans that I mentioned to you costs about 80 cents to ship, you know, if made in Malaysia or Indonesia or somewhere like that. So you can imagine, you know, the ability to increase demand and profit through these global supply chains.
Yeah, and there's something interesting. I didn't pull the quote. I thought I did, but you also talk about shipping containers. Again, a lot of us take this for granted. We buy our stuff. People buy on Amazon, and then it'll get shipped from across the planet. But it's really, I think, interesting to understand. You briefly mentioned how, you know, this came about. How someone many decades ago developed, you know, the first shipping container to system. Could you tell us a little bit about that sort of system, how it came to be, you know, how shipping containers are one of the key ways we get our stuff today?
Yeah, so there's two containers that are used in supply chain. One is something called a pallet. And if you go into a Costco, you'll see, you know, all the materials that are sitting on top of pallets. So that's how we move things around a country. And then someone thought, well, maybe we needed to standardize how we move things around the planet, because before they would just put things on ships. But, you know, there was only so much capacity on a ship. But if you cube it, which means you put, no matter what the shape of the product is, in a cube, which is, you know, a 20 or 40 foot container, you've seen those ships that have like seven stories, eight stories of containers. So that just, by that standardization, now all of a sudden you don't have things coming into the United States different from Malaysia versus China and then back and forth. So you can imagine how much capacity now we have to ship things around the world, as well as being able to reduce the costs, which also another important fact to know about this, it unleashed the number of people in the world who can work in manufacturing. So right now we have hundreds of thousands of people who want to do manufacturing, which fortunately, it keeps our costs down. But unfortunately, it also brings down labor costs, which means, you know, we'll never make a pair of jeans in the United States ever again.
That is fascinating. You know, there might be small businesses, right, that produce jeans in America, but their market base might be small because they'll have to sell them for a much higher price. No.
Nah, not really. I mean, you know, I guess there is some boutique or something like that. But for the most part, I mean, there are opportunities for manufacturing in the United States, where I talk about in my book. I mean, I grew up in an old Rust Belt city of Baltimore, which has never recovered from what happened in the supply chain. So politicians who suggest that we need to make things that we used to make are demagogues. You know, they're just doing that to pander for votes instead of being more imaginative and figuring a new way to bring people back into manufacturing.
Yeah, and you, as you mentioned the Rust Belt, you spend a portion of your book discussing the consequences, you know, of what has happened in the United States, the deindustrialization. If I read it correctly, you compare some of those effects to, you know, I think slavery and the treatment of Native Americans, and how in, you know, many places the steel industry, for example, has been eviscerated, and how the manufacturing of the mid 20th century, I mean, you talk about how entire towns, like the demographics there just increased by the tens and tens of thousands. And then after it all ended, it just kind of collapsed. And maybe if you could tell us a bit about the effects on America.
Yeah, I can tell you a personal story. I grew up in Baltimore, and I grew up right in the midst of deindustrialization. So Baltimore is a seaport town. Used to have one of the largest shipyards in the world. Was known for, you know, being one of those arsenal democracy cities that helped the United States win World War II. My relatives worked in blue collar jobs, worked in those fields. And then as I was growing up, I started to see all that just come apart. The people knew the jobs were leaving. They didn't know where they were going. They just knew that they weren't there. So, you know, family members I had where, you know, the father worked, the mother stayed at home, and, you know, was able to live a good, solid middle class lifestyle, that all just disappeared. So what happened is everybody who could leave cities like Baltimore, Flint, Michigan, or two cities that I mentioned, they left. And then, you know, all that was left was a lower tax base and people who couldn't get out. And so, you know, to shift to the story of Flint, used to be called Vehicle City, was really where, you know, automobile manufacturing was started. And so eventually everything left Flint. And then the tax base went down. The city went bankrupt. The governor of Michigan took over the city and decided to save money and the water source. Instead of receiving water from Lake Huron, they received it from the Flint River. Problem is, the Flint River was never remediated when GM left town. And so the water was not in the circumstance to drink. And then next thing you know, you have a water crisis. So these circumstances that happen, water crisis in Flint, riots in Baltimore, these are not, you know, without any sort of cause effect with what happened in deindustrialization. And most people don't experience this because cities like Flint and cities like Baltimore are drive around towns. There's parts in the United States that we call flyover country, rural parts of the country where nobody really pays attention to. But these used to be the places where textiles were made and coal was mined. And these places are now experiencing crises in the number of people who live in the towns, opioid epidemic, pandemic that's happening, where people are really very upset. And so you see this political divide that's happening of people who feel like they're on the outside. I trace a lot of those roots to deindustrialization, something that slowly happened over 40, 50 years.
Yeah, and I've been in my travels this year in the U.S., I've been noticing, especially, you know, I'm originally from Chicago, Illinois. So you see, again, increasing crime, economic problems, homelessness. I was in Texas recently in Austin, and people living there that I know, and myself, I was just shocked to see the level, the increased homelessness, which I think has to do with, as you say, the deindustrialization, the higher cost of living in inflation, the erosion of the middle class blue collar jobs, as you mentioned, you know, it used to be many, you know, I'm a Croatian American. Many of my, you know, my father and his peers came in to the U.S. in the 70s and 80s, not even speaking English. And they were able to, you know, build a, you know, a nice middle class lifestyle where the wife didn't even have to work. I think those days are long gone. And you mentioned demographics also. What's important for us to know regarding demographics?
Yeah. So first, before I move on to demographics, is that the numbers regarding what you and I just talked about are shocking. Like one book reviewer called my book a diatribe because he expected me just to talk about the technical aspects of supply chain. And what I try to do is dig into the roots to explain to people how supply chains have impacted society. Because, you know, you said some people may find supply chain boring, and yeah, like how you ship or an inventory and everything like I teach in my classes. You know, if you're a non-supply chain person, you may see those things as boring. But what's surprising to me is how people have not been able to make the connection between what's happened in these boneyards of America's industry and what's happened to society. And when you see homeless people and opioid problems and you see these problems and not drawing the correlation of what's happened for 40 years. Now, to your question regarding demographics, another thing that's happening in the supply chain today, and it's not just happening in the United States, it's happening around the world. And I've been to China twice this year. It's shocking what's happening regarding the globalization related to population declines. I think there's like 194 countries in the world, and more than half of them are experiencing a population growth that's lower than what the natural rate needs to be. I think the natural rate needs to be 2.1 children for every female. In most countries, and not just, you know, European countries that you'd suspect, like Germany, Belgium, and places like that, but China is experiencing major demographic or population declines, South Korea, all the Asian countries. The United States is, but we have a really healthy immigration system, so that allows us. But, you know, regarding this balance between supply and demand, so we've had 40 or 50 years of deindustrialization, which has created this global supply chain where there's an imbalance between who's producing and who's consuming. And now you're ripping that fabric even greater after COVID with these population declines. And the problem isn't not having enough workers because you can automate and use technology. Problem is not having enough consumers. And that's what's creating the greatest challenge we're having right now in our supply chains.
Yeah, I mean, I got so many questions. You also mentioned that I think you begged that question in the future. I guess I'll get to it. It's lost somewhere here in my notes. But you mentioned COVID. You know, what? How would you assess the impact that, you know, from 2020 until even, you know, today, the impact that the COVID and the government response has been to the supply chain?
Yeah. So before COVID, I built a supply chain program at the University of Denver. Nobody wanted to talk about supply chain then. I never got any media requests from our public relations department at the university. And next thing you know, COVID happens. And this precarious balance between supply and demand started to break down. And, you know, you heard the stories about toilet paper, which, by the way, what's important for people to understand is that, you know, certain products are not the same with what you use at home versus what you use in like a commercial setting. So, you know, the toilet paper you get at home or the steaks you eat are different than the ones you buy at a restaurant. So there was an imbalance between those products. And what we saw with COVID was basically opening everybody's eyes of what was broken to the supply chain that some people have seen for 40 years, which you and I just talked about. But some people didn't notice these things because it didn't impact them because they work in service and everything like that. Next thing you know, forget about like steaks and toilet paper and beer, but like now we're talking about pharmaceuticals, your parents' chemotherapy session was canceled because they didn't have the drug, or we don't have enough PPE to fight a pandemic. And next thing you know, people started paying attention to this. But the moral of the story is that this was just a continuation of what was broken over 40 years. And so after COVID ended, everybody expected the world to go back to normal. But the world's largest manufacturing country, China, has not gotten back to normal since COVID. And what's happening is the global structure of how supply chains work is this, the capacity is still there, but the demand isn't. And so, like, a lot of the things that happened in COVID have already been addressed. It's led to higher prices because basically companies carry more inventory because they try to be safer about things. And so more inventory means more costs. But just in general, how trade flows around the world has not recovered since COVID. It will never be what it was before COVID. It will be different. And so what I talk about in my book is, and by the way, I wrote this before COVID, is that we need a new model supply chain to account for what needs to happen in the future.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a bit. And you know, one more thing you touch on, we're hearing a lot of calls for nearshoring, reshoring, for bringing manufacturing regional, you know, pulling away from China. We're seeing here in Mexico, a lot of the FDI is increasing, foreign direct investment. Nearshoring is happening. Someone told me recently that works in industry here in Mexico that their higher ups had a meeting, and they were talking about how they are planning to pull away from China because they're expecting a war with China. We hear a lot of that talk. So that's interesting. But then you also write, I'm going to read a quote, during these serious challenges related to COVID and global conflict, nations must continue to focus on the natural resources required to power their economies. I thought this was an interesting note. You said, consider an average of 10,000 pairs of jeans in a 20-foot container. The cost to ship across the ocean has increased to $1 a pair versus 15 cents a pair earlier, which is not a material cost increase on a $70 piece of clothing. The media has made a big deal over this so-called supply chain crisis, but the calculus still favors these global systems. Any calls for the reshoring of supply chains have their work ahead of them to make the math work favorably. And so, you know, thoughts on this idea of nearshoring or reshoring or creating these regional economies?
Yeah. So great question. So the FDI, the investment into China has been dropping off a cliff. Investments into places like Mexico have been increasing. But we need to keep in mind that that China has 1.3 billion people and Mexico is like 60 million, right?
We got about 120 million now.
Okay. So sorry, got that wrong. But still, right? It's a magnitude of 1.2 or something like that. So for all intent and purposes, for this North American supply chain to work, Mexico needs a Mexico, right? So what's going to happen is, like, manufacturing in Mexico is going to increase. Hopefully it'll move farther into the South, you know, expand the capacity of manufacturing down into the South. But still, from a capacity standpoint, it's way short. There needs to be greater infrastructure investments. Your point about the jeans, what makes China China is its amazing infrastructure. Inland infrastructure and port infrastructure. So, you know, there has been conversations about India and, you know, it's called friendshoring. So moving away from China into countries that are more friendly with the United States. But these countries do not have the capital investment in their infrastructure to be competitive with China. So, you know, you see it, you see this so-called movement away from China. I think some of it is Pollyannish. I don't think it's possible. I think it's harmful. The other thing that's good about, you know, direct investments between the United States and China is countries that trade with each other are less likely to go to war. Because people like us, you know, I've been over there, they're great people, right? It's just this, you get into these, you know, tariffs and, you know, then you get into a shooting battle and next thing you know, things start to break down. So I think there's great hope for, you know, this North American supply chain. But I think right now it's more theory than it is in practice.
All right. And another key question is the demand aspect, which you touched on. I'm going to read a few quotes here. You write,
quote, Amazon's investments are exceptional, with 40% of its procurement automated, soon to be 80%, leading to cost savings of 3 to 10%. But by aiming to delight consumers with tighter fulfillment windows, wider selection, and lower costs, an increasingly widening disconnect continues to take shape between us as workers and as shoppers in this hyper-competitive model. You talk about Schumpeter's creative destruction and how today's calculus increasingly favors the consumer and investor and disfavors workers and citizens. You talk about Alvin Toffler, who describes the post-industrial society, implying that manufacturing is no longer a requirement for the American economy. But the Amazon thing, you say, as Amazon continues to delight customers with faster, more convenient, and lower cost ways of buying products, the question is, who will be buying products from them once robots and AI bots are running the entire supply chain? And does this consumption model only succeed when it continues to require us to buy more stuff? And I think a lot of us have been asking these questions. What happens when Skynet becomes self-aware? What's going to go on there?
This is the major question, and it's been around since the 1950s. There's a story of, one of the union guys was walking around a factory with Henry Ford Jr., and Henry Ford Jr. said, "Hey, I have these new robots. How are you going to get them to pay dues?" And the union guy said, "Well, that's not what I'm worried about." And Henry Ford said, "What are you worried about?" He said, "How are you going to get them to buy your cars?" So this has been around for 70 years, right? This question of use of technology. And so right now, the way it's heading, again, we're talking about demographics, fewer people. So it doesn't seem like we have a labor problem, because, even in the United States, unemployment is low. But if you look at the types of jobs that are available, part of the reason why unemployment is low, and it doesn't seem that way, is some people have two or three jobs to pay for things, right? So the problem is technology is moving up the hierarchy into jobs like that people are white collar professionals like me and you would take. And then you get into a problem of, everybody's employed, but nobody can afford things. And especially when you have, what's happening right now with commodities, prices are higher. You get into this, I think we're in this vicious cycle right now where the supply chain and the approach to government spending is unsustainable. And you're starting to see that happening. A lot of people don't think that we're going to, we could potentially go into a recession with what's happening in China and a global economy. And there's no good answers in sight. So the question that I pose in the book is, how do you use this technology instead of commoditizing goods and commoditizing labor to enable labor, to enable growth? And that's one area that hasn't been much in discussion.
Yeah. And before getting to that, you mentioned we're white collar, although today we're blue collar. But
I knew you were going to say that.
I just can't help myself. But also the Ukraine war's impact on the supply chain. One of the biggest topics has been the grain, the wheat coming out of Ukraine, and then the transit routes through the Black Sea being blocked and so forth. And what impact has the war in Ukraine had on supply chains?
Well, it's interesting. I was just having this conversation with a client earlier today. The expectations of the impact has been much different than it's played out. Now, as is always the case when it comes to instability in supply chains, it's the poorest who always pay the greatest price. So, poor countries in Middle East and Africa have had, problems with food shortages for sure. But the impact on Europe has not been much at all. In fact, I work in the beer industry, so we talk about aluminum. And so there was expectations that energy prices were going to equal the actual cost of the aluminum itself, and that you would no longer be doing manufacturing in Europe. Well, goes to show, despite the fact that there's a war, European countries are buying as much aluminum from Russia as they did before. So the big Russian aluminum company called Rusal, a third of their revenue is from Europe. And so everybody thought that would disappear. There's tariffs from the UK and the US, but there's still the flow of products. In fact, Energy is the same way. I mean, there's ways that energy, even with tariffs and embargoes, that, you know, if you mix a certain amount of, you know, if you ship it from one location, it can come into Europe. So, you know, the supply chain basically operates around these problems. It has led to greater inflation, but for the most part, the impact of what's been talked about is not as great as everybody initially thought. I think there's bigger problems at hand.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about China, because, you know, here's just a quote from your book. You say production accounts for 27% of China's economy and 20% of the world's output versus the U.S. at 12% and 18%. From a Chinese perspective, its intentions are not to control global supply chains and markets per se, but rather to ensure market stability and independence from U.S. companies. The reality is that China faces domestic economic challenges equal to, if not more significant than that of the United States. And the Wall Street Journal, I think, just recently published something along these lines as well, that China is facing problems. I mean, everyone's facing problems, but China might be facing greater problems. I don't know. I mean, your thoughts on China's situation as well as, you know, Belt and Road, which you touch on in the book.
Yeah, so China is a big nation without the same degree of resources that other big nations like Russia, the United States, Canada have, right? So it's very much reliant on energy from other nations. It's reliant on food from other nations. And so its workforce was the driving factor of what, you know, took a very poor country in the 20th century into the second largest economy in the world, you know, that it is today. It's very much of a controlled economy. That has to do with the culture of China, you know, 2,000-year-old country with, you know, more of a controlled politics, controlled economy, which thwarts innovation and thwarts capital. The capital moved to China based on low labor rates and fantastic infrastructure, because the country just dumped a bunch of money building ports, building bridges, buildings, you know, sky rises. If you go there, you just see everything built, right? So everybody moved from the farms into the cities. And so that led to, you know, more stable economic situation. It led to less poverty. They pulled hundreds of millions of people from out of poverty, but it's reached its point of what it's been able to do. And China realizes that they need to be able to be more self-reliant as opposed to making toys and making, you know, water bottles and stuff like that. And I think that's where the problem with innovation has become a problem. And people are moving away from China because of labor costs, you know, geopolitics, things like that. And the country needs to have a economic growth rate of like 8 or 9% in order to continue to pull more people from out of poverty. It's not growing at that rate. The young generation does not have the same opportunities as their parents. And so you've already had the you know, the one child policy that reduced populations. And now that's been liberated, but nobody can afford to have kids. And so it's perpetuating into a greater problem. So, you know, as much as everybody looks at China and says, well, they're the next world superpower, they need a lot of help. And I, like I said, I've been over there and I've tried to help on some things. And I would definitely suggest that they have greater challenges when it comes to what's happening moving forward than we have. So I don't fear things as much. I wish there wasn't as much animosity between the governments. Because I think the two economies really need each other. And I think that's another area that is actually pulling down the world economy, is this geopolitical tension. So, I definitely have concerns about what's happening in China. And I think it's bad for world stability. And again, like focusing on the big problems that we need to work on together, like pandemics and environmental, you know, challenges and stuff like that is again, that's going to continue to hurt the world economy.
I've had experts on the podcast in the past couple of years mention how the problem is now that all nations are facing this problem where there's no more growth. And then the game is not being able to outgrow or defeat the other, your adversary. It's to be that everything's, you mentioned demographics, you know, the debt levels that governments have, like this sort of collapse scenario, and that the game is, you want to be the last one to collapse. And so countries are kind of, I think that it's kind of like an inverted way of looking at it. And I think that also makes some sense. And then maybe to discuss.
Can I comment on that? That's an example of how capitalism has been bastardized over the last 100 years. That's, you know, that's a lack of original thinking of how to solve a problem. So what has allowed the world to grow, the world economy to grow? If you look at like any chart that looks at, you know, economic growth over the first 2,000 years of the last 2,000 years of civilization has been nothing. And then starting in the late 19th century, it just takes off like a rocket ship. And then it starts to plateau in the 21st century right now. And so you have policymakers and economists who are trying to, you know, use the same methodologies, which you just mentioned, to grow the economy when it's clear that it needs to take a new approach. And so I just think that that's just really unfortunate that, like, that's how we're going to try to, like, look at how, I mean, like, if you look at what Adam Smith wrote about, you know, capitalism and how it should be propagated, we've just lost that in what's happening today. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah. You mentioned Malthus and how he was wrong. And then the way forward, then let's look at that. You talk about a 21st century American dream, MASA, make America smart again, and that it can neither be a restoration of manufacturing's past nor the transition of all Americans to white collar knowledge work. You talk about a 21st century supply chain system, you know, maybe through another Manhattan Project or Marshall Plan. And so if you want to tell us a bit more about the way forward.
Yeah. So, you know, I go back to Adam Smith, and, you know, it's kind of eerie. So Adam Smith was around in the end of the 18th century, and he promoted this concept. He didn't call it capitalism. We call it him the father of capitalism. But basically, he talked about deploying capital to the greatest area of opportunity, as opposed to, you know, government and these mercantilists hoarding capital for their own benefit, as opposed to enabling society. And so this term capitalism has been used as this concept of free market capitalism, of letting big companies monopolize, you know, technology and innovations, which is kind of a problem today, as opposed to liberating capital and technology to enabling more of a balance between supply and demand. And so in my book, what I talk about is this concept of a community-based supply chain, where the municipality invests the capital in the technology, and then it allows the people who live in that municipality to use that capital or use that technology for a utility fee. So it's not something that's run by the government, but it's the same thing as a water utility or an electrical utility, where you allow people to create their own supply chains without needing capital to do so. Because, you know, innovators today are prohibited from solving problems because they don't have the capital to be able to do it, because big companies like Facebook and all these big companies basically leave people on the outside because they can't afford to achieve it. So this is, in my opinion, how Adam Smith would view capitalism today. He would look at capitalism today and say, well, this is the same problem that we had in the 18th century, where the capital is only being deployed for big companies. We call them today multinational corporations or big governments. And then we have these conversations of, do we, you know, am I in favor of the government or I'm in favor of the corporation? Where Adam Smith would tell you they're both doing the same thing. And so I look at this as a liberation of technology through supply chains. And it's the way we can solve the supply and demand problem in places like Baltimore and Flint and rural towns.
It's interesting you mentioned in your book, a potpourri of mass media television news options must compete with the maker's market of do-it-yourself media through podcasts like that. That's why you're on Geopolitics and Empire now. A lot of people are losing faith in the mainstream. That's why they listen to do-it-yourself podcasts like little old me. But you talk about the value chain, nodal supply chain is moving in the same direction today, being prototyped through hobbyists and STEM enthusiasts in the hacker sphere. It will ultimately become the new supply chain, a virtual one that exists in the physical world available to all. You also talk about, you know, how can Amazon, a company worth $1.5 trillion, make money by shipping products for free for Prime members? This 21st century model built on this new value proposition and used by big tech consistently serves a different purpose in the market setting and could become the basis of a valuable new American dream model for individuals and communities. And this, an American Silk Road. And, you know, thoughts on that. And I'm also curious, you know, how does Amazon make so much money? I mean, are they doing a good job, or do they have a huge debt? I mean, how do they succeed?
So the reason why Amazon is Amazon is they are the world leader when it comes to data centers. So they are an information-based company. They have trucks that go all over the place, but they win through information. So they gather information about you. They have algorithms. They try to predict what you're going to buy. They try to suggest what you should buy in order to be able to keep their inventory levels low. And then what they try to do is try to commoditize the rest of the supply chain, how the warehouses work, how the products get to your doorstep. And then, you know, to your point, they don't focus as much on profitability as they do on growth. But again, what we just talked about is now you've commoditized the consumer. So we're just people clicking buttons and getting things at our doorstep. You've just commoditized the people who work at the distribution center. You've just commoditized the truck driver who's got to speed around your neighborhood in order to hit these numbers. So the whole model is commoditized. And so how does this story end? I mean, Walmart and Amazon are competing against each other. They just keep, you know, having shipping costs lower. Instead of you getting it in 2 days, you get it in 1 day. Instead of you getting it for 1 day, you get it in a half a day. And all that ends up doing is taking away it commoditizes supply and demand experience. So we all just become consumers and people who are a part of this demand chain, as opposed to what I talked about was a value chain, where we focus on supply chains that enable us to succeed. We enable people to get back into the supply chain by, like you mentioned, being makers. I want to be a truck driver, so I create my own company across this value chain where I can run my own truck and I can work for you. So it's utilization of information, not just for $1.5 trillion companies, but for individuals like us. And you use the term that I called in the book, we all become nodes. So we connect to each other in flexible ways, as opposed to these big companies dominating how things operate.
One problem you also discuss is the digital divide. So this would mean that you'd have to build out like internet infrastructure, and then get people, you know, the elderly generation or conservative crowd or whatever, to start learn how to use these apps. Although I think with the next generation, that probably won't be a problem. But thoughts on the digital divide?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bigger problem than is advertised, because there is a difference between the education you get in certain places. You know, the educational system that we have today in a lot of public school systems is the same education system that was put in place 100 years ago when we were looking at training people to run an assembly line. You know, we haven't changed it for inner cities. We haven't changed it for rural towns. How you utilize technology in order to, you know, be an information, you know, like you mentioned, Alvin Toffler and Peter Drucker and these guys talk about information workers. People like you and I have become those people. But there's a big percentage, there's unfortunately too large a percentage of the US population that is on the outside of this, that doesn't have proper internet, doesn't have proper skills. And so if we're going to change how manufacturing works in the future, it's more likely that people like you and I are working in that space than them. The question is, how do we break that digital divide to get them to have a more inclusive economy to where things need to head so that they don't have to end up doing commoditized jobs?
Yeah. And in the second half of your book, you go much more into detail about, your 21st century, American Silk Road. And your vision is very, it's optimistic. It's positive. You know, I think it's a good plan. You talk about peer-to-peer retails, some of what's already happening, like with us podcasters, right? I'm about to open a merchandise store. We ask like value for value proposition. You know, if people like what I'm doing, please donate. And then that keeps us going. And, you know, from all parts of the world. But I've got a criticism here. What happens when, the system you're talking about, more digitalization, you talk about big oil now has become big data and blockchain. We're now in this virtual digital technological space, which there's a lot of great things. But, you know, what happens when governments and corporations start behaving fascist? And, you know, back in 2021, I was blocked from Patreon. So that way of me making a living was shut. Last year, the Department of Homeland Security blocked me forever from PayPal, just because I'm having conversations that they don't like. We're seeing people getting debanked now. And so that's one worry I have in all of this. Do you have any thoughts about some of these developments?
Yeah, and I think you should be worried. And, you know, the model that I created isn't a replacement of these big government and big corporate influences. It's an alternative to it. And, you know, there are circumstances where things are going to happen, like you just mentioned. But my thought is, what are the alternatives? I mean, unless you create some sort of open source marketplace. So, you know, if cities like Baltimore and Flint say, well, we're going to create this open source marketplace, I'm hoping that would be looked at as an alternative to Amazon or to government running these things. And, you know, people will raise questions about it. And my response is, yeah, sure, that's a concern. But what is the alternative to that? Because we continue to head down the consolidation path where, you know, all of your social media is done by these guys and all of your, you know, e-commerce is done by those guys. I have an optimistic vision that, you know, if people see a different path where it's not as much about consolidation as much more of a balance between supply and demand, like supply chains were, you know, a while back, then that's the better, not just better economic model, but it's the better societal model. And it's the better technological model where technology is liberated as opposed to consolidated.
Yeah. And so you're saying with your model, it would provide alternatives.
Exactly. Yeah. So all you need is, you know, a city, some sort of municipality to say, we're going to build this community-based model. And again, it's not, you know, the term community-based, people are like, oh, the government's going to run it. The government's simply going to invest in the capital to allow the individuals to be entrepreneurial and innovative. And that's what capitalism is all about, right? So I had one reviewer who told me I was a socialist. And I was like, wait a minute, like you're enabling individuals to compete in a capitalist model. Like if you actually read Adam Smith, that's the actual definition of capitalism that he talked about. Mercantilism, where it's all consolidated, is not what he considers to be capitalism. So, and my point is you allow the community to allow this to flourish and see where that goes.
Yeah, I've had also people email me like, are you an anarchist voluntarist? And I'm like, no, I don't want to do away with all government. I want the smallest government possible but you know, you want to make sure you have a good government, and you know, there are benefits to government. I just, you know, we don't want a big sloppy government, but
But if the government laid the infrastructure for individuals to compete and to thrive and to be entrepreneurial, that's a great use of government.
Yeah, I mean, we've got, you know, a number of things, so far that we've gotten this far with government. But that's another discussion. Energy, you also touched on energy. How was that important today in the 21st century supply chain?
Well, what's interesting is the definition of energy is changing. So in this new model, you know, you're going to have, we have these long-tailed supply chains, like the masks that we had shortages of during COVID are made in like a few Chinese factories. So, you know, it's a long-tailed supply chain where, you know, these materials have to travel thousands of miles in order for us to use them. So a lot of energy used in that. So we're transitioning from a long-tailed supply chain to more of a technological supply chain where energy becomes, where the supply chain becomes local, but it also becomes more information-based, and information requires energy, right? So it's more of a, I think it's more of a smart energy model. It's a network model of communities, as opposed to, you know, everything in the, all the pharmaceuticals are made in India or China, and then we have to ship them long distances.
All right. Are there any other themes that I failed to bring up that you want to get across or final thoughts?
Yeah, I think when we think of technology, we have to think of how we deploy technology for the public good and the private enterprise. And so how do we balance these two together? You know, how do we create education to balance as well? And I think, you know, the main theme for my book is our supply chains are out of balance. And so across the planet, they're balanced, but they're imbalanced, in fact, in that some places are making things for a dollar an hour and some places are consuming without making. And so how do we create these environments where across the planet, but specifically in your community, like the one I grew up in, how do we create a model where consumers and producers are more in balance? You know, instead of looking at, you know, Baltimore as a place that has crime, I mean, what do you expect people to do that don't have opportunities, right? So how does the government use capital in order to create these balances? And I think if we got one lesson from COVID and what's happened with the war, is that these supply chains are out of balance and we need them to better serve not just consumers and stockholders, but citizens and producers or workers.
All right. Yeah. As I've mentioned, it's been an enjoyable read your book and I'm learning something new. Supply chains. Doesn't seem you don't have a strong social media presence. Is there any place to best find you or to get the book?
Yeah, I mean, I have a stronger presence on LinkedIn, and then you can go on Amazon and get the book. I've had great conversations with people who've purchased the book, so you can reach me through my email or my LinkedIn. I've actually had conversations with communities or organizations in order to. How do we take these models and take them forward? Actually talking to people in China as well. So even though the book's focusing on the challenges that are happening in the United States, some of these same problems with deindustrialization are happening worldwide. So, just want to have a conversation on how we create more of a balance in how we consume and produce.
Yeah, and parts of your solution overlap with people in the alternative media community who are trying to come together and build local communities in different parts of the world to sort of stave off some of what's been going on in the world. And some of your solutions seem to overlap with theirs. And so, again, people can get the book Reinventing the Supply Chain, a 21st Century Covenant with America, anywhere books are sold or in digital or physical format. And thank you, Professor Buffington, for being on Geopolitics and Empire.
It was quite a pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this Geopolitics and Empire podcast. The website is geopoliticsandempire.com, and I encourage you to sign up for the free email list that goes out with each podcast and every weekend with a collection of news headlines. The newsletter and website are our last lines of defense. We're being censored and deplatformed. It's nearly impossible to find Geopolitics and Empire on the Google search engine. We've been blacklisted. YouTube frequently takes down our videos with strikes. Facebook restricts our page. Reddit and Twitter take down posts. And after the Associated Press mentioned Geopolitics and Empire in a 2021 article co-written with NATO, our Patreon account was terminated. Vimeo also terminated our pro account. The best free way to help Geopolitics and Empire is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere and subscribe to all of our media channels. You can find the video broadcast now on 5 platforms: Odyssey, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, and Brighteon. You can find the audio broadcast on the podcast ecosystem: SoundCloud, Apple, Spotify, and so on. My current favorite social media channels are Twitter and Telegram, but you can also find us on Gab, MeWe, Minds, Float, VK, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Finally, Geopolitics and Empire is in dire need of funding to continue. You can leave a donation, purchase a consultation with the host, or become a member to receive additional benefits. We also produce a weekly broadcast called Dissident Thinker for members and Rockfin subscribers only. We will continue to fight the good fight, come hell or high water. Thank you for listening.